Hello and welcome to the latest Brewing podcast and a stock-specific discussion today as we speak with Blake Hutchins of Investec. We look at Rolls-Royce, Integrafin, I think that's its name, and Tesco. And here's just a quick comment from Blake on his market perception of Tesco currently.
It takes a long time for the market and for investors to change their perception around a company, and I think that's where we are with Tesco.
Okay, so only a brief insight there, but for far deeper analysis, please keep listening. A really interesting 30 minutes, about 10 minutes on each company. But first, here are our disclaimers.
The value of investments can fall and you may get back less than you invested. Past performance is not a reliable guide to future performance. The podcast is not intended as investment advice. No investment is suitable in all cases. Any tax allowances or thresholds mentioned are based on personal circumstances and current legislation, which may change. We or a connected party may have an interest in the securities mentioned or may act as principal or agent in those securities from time to time. The podcast content comes from diverse sources whose accuracy cannot be assured. The opinions expressed in this publication are not necessarily held throughout Brewin Dolphin. Investment in currencies other than your own means changes in the exchange rate will cause the value of your investment to move independently of the underlying asset.
Hello everyone and welcome to the latest Brewin podcast. I'm Ben Gutteridge, Head of Fund Research. And today we're delighted to be joined by Blake Hutchins, the Lead Manager on the Investec UK Equity Income Fund, and the co-lead on their Global Quality Equity Income Fund, and without a doubt, the most high-profile equity fund manager at Investec. I think today we're going to have more of a stock-based conversation rather than some of the more macro-type debates that we have normally. The companies we're going to choose to discuss are Tesco, Rolls-Royce, and Integrafin. Integrafin.
Yeah.
And that's how much I know about that company. And we're going to talk about those companies in that order on the basis that, I know increasingly little about each company in that order. So we're going to start on Tesco, the company I know most about. And let me get this straight. That's a big shop, isn't it?
Reasonably big shop.
Right, okay.
You've probably been there before.
I think I do know a little bit better than that. Okay, so where to start on Tesco? I guess the share price has been on a nice run, and it's really impressed on its margins, hasn't it? So I guess, can that story be pushed even further?
Yeah, so for us, it's an interesting one. And in the UK Equity Income Fund, the Investec UK Equity Income Fund, we basically invest in two types of businesses. We got our steady quality compounders, and we have those companies going through positive change. And Tesco is definitely in the latter camp. I wouldn't claim it's a quality compounder, certainly not yet, but it's absolutely in the camp of going through positive change, led by Dave Lewis, a very able CEO, and actually since the Booker transaction, Charles Wilson also. So what would I say about Tesco and the margins? And to be honest, the market is very, very fixated on the margin, and the company are guiding to margins. For me, the margin is an output rather than an input, and actually I think you're missing a trick if you focus just on the margin. This is all about scale. Tesco undeniably have scale in the UK. What have they got? 30% plus market share of the food retail industry. The next biggest competitor, whether that's Sainsbury's or Asda, has less than half that amount, 10% or so. And it's how you use the scale of Tesco's market position. And back in the day when they got it wrong, I think they used that scale to basically take advantage of customers and to push pricing far too high. And you saw their margins were actually too high. They were charging us too much for our groceries. Where are they now? They're in the exact opposite position. They're using their scale to be very, very competitive and to dominate the competition. If you are twice the size of your nearest competitor, you are buying more than twice the amount of food of your nearest competitor. And there is no doubt in my mind that Tesco should get very material scale benefits of being that much bigger than their competition, which they can either use to fleece the customer, which is what they used to do, or they use it to drive prices lower for us. And then they drive incremental volumes, and then the model becomes very, very virtuous, such is the case with many discount retailers, which we've seen time and again. And that is the most interesting thing for me for Tesco. They're going to keep their margins. Okay, margins are going to go up because they're doing a better job. They've got cost savings. They're closing non-food. But really, the opportunity for them is to drive volumes through a very, very efficient network and driving prices materially lower for consumers, and then enjoying the virtuous economics that come with that.
So the competitive threats of this sort of Sainsbury's and Asda merger and the benefits of scale that could bring for them, and the competitive forces that may inflict on Tesco, clearly not a sufficient threat.
It's a really positive endorsement of Tesco's current strategy. Tesco have that market share, and Sainsbury's and Asda feel like they've got to do something to compensate for that, to get competitive with Tesco. And I think in 5 years, 6 years, 7 years' time, once they've really sorted it out, that will be something that we need to address with Tesco. But this deal will take a long time to go through. And they're at the moment talking about running the two brands separately, which I think is inevitably what they're going to have to do. But that provides, you know, a lot of opportunity for Tesco. If you put two different brands together with different back ends, different supplier arrangements, you might get some benefits of scale, but it's not like going to market with one single brand, one unified business in the way that Tesco does. So yeah, we've got to keep it on our radar. I think it'll take a long time, which provides amazing opportunity to capitalize on that. But I think it's a positive endorsement of Tesco's strategy. You know, it's all about scale. This is a low margin, high asset turn industry. And as soon as you get away from that, I think the strategy goes wrong. So yeah, that's what I would say on that merger.
Okay, and in regards to management, I know you place a lot of stock in both Dave Lewis, a former guest on this podcast, and Charlie Wilson. What is the commitments from Charlie Wilson to the firm? Is now under some threat. I mean, clearly he's very passionate management, but there are some health concerns.
Yeah, and that's very unfortunate. I mean, the good news is that his treatment went well, and currently he is healthy, which is fantastic. Look, I still think Charles Wilson will be very involved in the business. It's sensible that he takes a slightly reduced role. He comes off the board, but look, he's so vested in the business. He's got hundreds of millions of pounds tied up in the business. And the strategy is incredibly clear. You know, Dave Lewis and Charles Wilson are completely aligned on the strategy, but again, is back to this point of using their scale to an advantage and also using their assets more efficiently. When you've seen with Booker what they were able to do with their asset base is really sweat it, and to put much more sales in a fixed asset base and keeping margins flat. So your asset turn went up materially, and that improved the return on capital, the cash flows, and then Booker poured out cash flow and therefore dividends. And I think the strategy is going to be exactly the same with Tesco. It's almost the Booker blueprint on a bigger base, which is Tesco. So it's unfortunate. It's great that his treatment's gone well. I think the strategy is very, very well set now, and it's very clear. So I'm not too concerned about that.
Okay, so the strategy you're extremely confident in, and you've got the right personnel executing on that strategy. I guess there are some things that are out of Tesco's control, how the competitors react to Tesco's own strategy, but they're also, retail is notoriously a very difficult place to operate in, and lots of question marks surrounding the UK consumer. I mean, those sort of things out of the management's control, to what extent do they make you nervous about this as a share?
Yeah, I think, having that competitive advantage and that benefit of scale gives me a lot of comfort. I think the thing looking into the next 12 to 18 months, which is an issue for a lot of consumer stocks, and in fact, a lot of companies across the whole market, will be inflation, and it's cost inflation. And, we know that wages are going up. But whether that's because of legislation or marginal inflation pressures on cost bases, and then also food inflation is quite material. And we saw Tesco, the industry have talked about if we do leave the European Union and in a disorderly way, we're likely to see a further weakening of sterling, which means that we've got to buy food from the continent at higher prices. And the good thing with Tesco is that, because of their benefits of scale, they're going to be much better insulated than smaller peripheral competitors. But that is something that Tesco will have to take and pass on to the consumer, which will inevitably be difficult for you and me in the next 18 months in terms of managing our own cost base. So yeah, in terms of consumer stocks in general, I think you've got to be a little bit wary. There is inflation coming through, and you want to be in those companies that are best competitively advantaged to pass that through and to absorb those cost pressures.
Okay, now the next point I'm sure you could easily dismiss, but I mean the sell side analysts, for what it's worth, you know, have got a price, consensus price that isn't really too far away from where we are now. So basically what I'm saying is it appears as though the market's or the consensus believes that the market is up with events on Tesco. Mm. You know, is the valuation sort of reflecting all of this positive story?
Yeah, I don't think it is actually. And I think this is a stock where, and I was in this camp as well. You know, I was a bear on Tesco for a long time, all the way since 2007 until very recently. And it takes a long time for the market and for investors to change their perception around a company. And I think that's where we are with Tesco. I think analysts are behind the curve on this one. I don't obsess about what other people think about the company. We very much take our own view and value the company accordingly. But I think this is a classic case that, you know, there's still a lot of short interest in the sector. There's still a lot of people who've been burnt about being bulls at Tesco at £5 when all of the sell side were buyers. And there's still latent skepticism around Tesco. And the thing that I'm looking for, which I think will surprise, is the cash flow. You know, when this company gets volume growth, because retailers and food retailers have negative working capital, and because Tesco aren't spending a lot on CapEx because they don't need to, this company is going to pour cash flows. You know, it's going to be very, very cash generative. And if I look at, with my income hat on, dividend expectations for Tesco, they're very, very modest. You know, their current payout is, 30% of earnings. This is Booker. When they were really humming, they paid out all of their earnings, all of their cash flow as a dividend. So I think it's a great dividend growth stock, and that's being very much underappreciated by the market.
And we want to move on, but so the strategy you talk about leveraging the scale. I mean, what about the quality of product and the sort of refining the number of items and all of that, you know, some other things.
Yeah,
that,
reducing SKUs.
Well,
I think one thing to look out for, and, you know, they're doing a few trial stores to compete with the discounters. And if anyone can compete with the discounters for price, we know that the Aldi and Lidl's of this world have far lower SKUs. They don't have self-service checkouts. They have very basic fittings in their estate. So they have a natural cost advantage versus Tesco. But I come back to this point, when you are 30% of the market and you buy the quantity of food and you know, ambient goods and packaged goods that Tesco does, you know, you have an ability to compete on price. And I really come back to that core point, which, yes, reducing SKUs helps, closing non-food helps, you know, to reduce your cost base and improve your margins. But it all has to come back to driving prices lower for the consumer, to pick up incremental volumes, which means that you grow, your suppliers give you better terms, you have that virtuous cash generative business model because you have negative working capital, and then you can be a cash machine. And that's got to be the investment case for Tesco. And I don't think that's reflected in the market right now.
Okay, right. Well, we'll move on to Rolls Royce, another decent turnaround story as far as the market is concerned, and certainly a lot of restructuring going on. Why don't you sort of just a bit of context? You know, why Rolls Royce, you know, fell so foul of the market, and why, you know, what is behind the restructuring, and what have they embarked upon?
Yeah, so Rolls Royce again is in the camp in the portfolio in the UK Equity Income Fund of those companies going through positive change. I don't think anyone could claim that Rolls Royce is firing on all cylinders right now, and it's been quite a controversial stock over the past few years. And your listeners will be very aware of some of those issues. When I take a step back and think about what Rolls-Royce has been trying to achieve over the past 10 years, it's pretty phenomenal, actually. They have spent, since 2010, £11 billion on R&D and CapEx. And what has that gone into? That's gone into growing their market share of wide-body jet engines, which fly you and I long haul. You know, these aren't narrow body jet engines which fly a short haul. These are wide body jet engines which go across the Atlantic and, you know, and beyond. That's not easy. And that £11 billion of incremental investment has had to be absorbed by a company that hasn't yet seen the growth come through. So what you've seen is them ploughing all of this money into CapEx, into R&D to really grow their market position. And we haven't seen the benefits of that come through yet because production has a long lead time. The interesting thing for me is that you've already sunk that 11 billion of CapEx. We know that the company's market share of wide-body jet engines is going to go from 35% today. And by the way, it was 14% 10 years ago. So it's actually gone from 14% to 35% today. And we know in the next 5 years, Rolls-Royce will have 55% market share of wide-body jet engine, which they share that market with GE. Now, that is an expensive operation to achieve. And to achieve that growth has taken a lot of restructuring, a lot of investment. And I'd say that Rolls-Royce back in the day focused very much on that big prize of achieving the growth, perhaps without focusing on the efficiency and, you know, the numbers to achieve that. Where we are now, where you're seeing their big six new engine programs come through, we think you're now in a position to get material operating leverage off that huge fixed cost that's gone into the business. And when you start to see that come through, we think the drop through from revenues to profits, the incremental profitability, the incremental return on capital that you're going to see from Rolls-Royce is going to be very, very violent in a positive way. And another stat that I'd give is that, you know, they're ramping up production for wide-body jet engines. They're currently able to, or they have historically been able to produce 150 wide-body jet engines a year. They are taking that number to 550 a year. And that goes back to my point that they've had to put in a lot of investment over the past 10 years, which is why you've seen that 11 billion of capital deployed.
So is it the case that sort of the investment cycle, heavy investment cycle phase is over, and not just sort of efficiencies can be made in sort of the production line, but that is going to be very helpful for cash flows? Or, I mean, presumably, it's still going to be a pretty intensive R&D business.
Absolutely. And the encouraging thing is that they're still investing in future engines. Last year, they announced...
So to the point about the investment cycle being over versus...
So this is a business that you want to reinvest. You know, yeah. They have a phenomenal market position. There's only two companies in the world that can do what they do from a technological standpoint, from an engineering standpoint. Rolls-Royce will always be a company that requires reinvestment, but to the point where we are today, they have deployed all of that capital. They're currently not generating a single pound of free cash flow. We think that as these engine programs start to ramp up, you could go from a position where you've actually seen negative free cash flow to a run rate of £1.5 to £2 billion of free cash flow generated by this company as these engines start to fly. Now, to put that into the context, the market cap today is £19 billion. So in very, very simple numbers, let's say there's £2 billion of free cash flow to come out of this company on a run rate basis. That might be a little bit optimistic, but let's say £2 billion. The market cap is around £20 billion. That's a 10% free cash flow yield. The market currently trades at around a 5% free cash flow yield. This stock won't double overnight, but that's quite conceivable that free cash flow yield could halve, i.e. Rolls-Royce shares could double, and that could happen over the next 3 to 5 years, which for us as investors provides a very attractive return in a market that's reasonably fully valued. So Rolls-Royce will always be a stock that needs to reinvest. They absolutely should reinvest. It's that reinvestment that has given them 55% market share of a very attractive market. And that's why I would put it into the context, Ben, of the fund. You know, we have two types of investment case, those quality compounders and those companies going through positive change. Will Rolls-Royce gravitate towards a quality compounder? Possibly not, for your point, you know, due to your point that it's always going to need some reinvestment. But this operating leverage that should come through Rolls-Royce in the next 5 years will be very, very powerful. And that journey from zero to a billion to possibly 2 billion of free cash flow is one that we're going to enjoy as investors, and particularly as income investors. Because if that cash flow comes through, you know, the dividend growth will come through as well.
Okay, so in terms of that operating leverage then and free cash flow story, I mean, what are the dynamics of, you know, the margins or the money lost on selling the engine versus flying hours versus obviously the servicing contracts that are the big wins for these for Rolls-Royce?
Yeah, so as you infer, a function of the model, and this wasn't always the case, the way that they structure their contracts now is they basically make a loss when they sell the engine, and then they recoup that very healthily and more through selling service contracts in the form of aftermarket total care contracts. So if you think about it, once you've sold those engines and you're at peak, once your orders are at peak, you're going to be absorbing a lot of working capital. You're going to be absorbing a lot of capex. You're going to be absorbing a lot of cost, a lot of fixed cost, which is exactly where Rolls-Royce have been over the past 3 years. Once these engines start flying, you start to generate cash flow. And I think that that transition from really ramping up production from 155 engines to 550, you know, that's where you absorb all the losses. And once these engines start flying, that's when you start to generate a lot of cash. And I think that we're at a really interesting time in the business's evolution, that those OE losses are starting to come to an end or starting to reduce as you start to ramp up flying hours on these new engines. And look, this isn't a riskless investment. And again, I put this into the context of the fund, and it's not the biggest position. You know, it's just sub 2% weighting in the fund. And it's not a stock that I would ever have a huge weighting in because of the inherent risks. And one of those risks you're starting to see at the moment, where they're having issues with their Trent 1000 engine. And that's something we didn't plan for. And that's something the company didn't plan for, and they're having to spend hundreds of millions of pounds to rectify this small issue on, well, I say small issue, this issue on the Trent 1000 engine. And, you know, I would just caveat that this is a business that will always require reinvestment. This is a company that takes a lot of technology risk and engineering risk. And so it's not a riskless investment, but I think that from where we've come from with Rolls-Royce and where we're going, you know, there's potentially very, very attractive returns for us as investors to make.
Okay, and then on that point, in terms of valuation, and again, it's strange I've sort of brought up this the sell side for two stocks in a row here, but we have seen some pretty bearish sell side analysts become bulls on it, you know, sort of in a relatively short order, perhaps in the same vein as Tesco. You know, the sell side has been pretty slow to get onto it. I don't know whether that's sort of comforting to you.
I think it's very similar. You know, these were stocks that a lot of people were very positive on, and perhaps lazily so when there was a really, you know, when they were trading at very high valuations and there was a lot of growth embedded in the share price. And, you know, we've seen this time and again, Ben, and I know you have and I have as well, in that, you know, analysts, when they're all buyers and there's no incremental seller, you know, and everything looks fantastic, that's obviously when these shares don't tend to be that interesting. Whereas right now, we like the fact there's still some bears that are turning to bulls, and there's still some people who are very skeptical. And I get thrown a lot of counter arguments to my investment thesis on Tesco and to Rolls-Royce. And we have to be alert to them. As I say, these aren't companies that we're necessarily going to buy and hold forever in the way that we do with other stocks. But I get a lot of comfort from the fact that there is still incremental buyers out there who I know were buyers at the top and who are yet to come back into the water. And I think that provides a good runway for us over the next 3 to 5 years to make good money out of both of these investments.
Okay, right. We'll move on to our final stock, IntegraFin, a name that our listeners may be less familiar with. We know their underlying business, Transact, here at Brewin Dolphin, but I'm sure we would appreciate just a broader overview of how the business operates.
Yeah, that's why I chose it. Actually, it's a bit of a hidden gem. It's not very well covered by the sell side, and I think it's not on the radar yet of a lot of investors. And back to my point earlier, where I said that I invest in two types of business: those going through positive change, like Tesco and Rolls-Royce, and then also the majority of the portfolio will always be, you know, my passion for investing in quality compounders. And that's where IntegraFin are. They're absolutely a quality compounder that have a very attractive runway for growth. So what do they do? They are the owners of the Transact platform, which serves 5,000 financial advisors here in the UK. Why is that a good business to be in? Well, I think that financial advisors in the UK are in quite a good spot. I think there's structural growth within the UK savings market, which I think the likes of Brewin Dolphin and other companies are enjoying. I think we've got a bit of a savings gap in the UK. We've got some good pension reform. We've got you know, increasing ISA contributions that have benefited. And you've seen the digitalization of savings which I think is a trend that's going to continue. So broadly, I think that the UK savings market is in a good place, and I think there's structural growth that's going to take place within the UK savings market. So when a financial advisor uses the Transact platform to manage their clients' wealth, and they get some nice inflows, as Bruins have got and others have also got, the nice thing about Transact is, or IntegraFin, is that they own the technology for their business. They are a fully scaled, technology-owning technology platform. And that means that when they accept incremental flows from their financial advisors, the 5,000 financial advisors that they serve, the incremental cost of putting those incremental assets on their platform is actually pretty low, because they own their technology, they get leverage on that, and they're very well invested. So that feeds through to a very high level of incremental profit when these flows come onto their platform. And also, because the business is very capital light, because it's a software company, they don't need to spend any incremental cash flow. So when they get incremental flows, when their assets under management or funds under direction grow, they get a really nice drop through to profits, which drops through fully to cash, which actually will drop through fully to free cash flow and therefore to dividends. And I think that's going to be a very, very powerful economic, the economics of IntegraFin will be very powerful over the next 10 to 15 years. And I expect to see material free cash flow growth and material dividend growth from this stock.
And is it that Transact, you think, has a growing, can participate equally with other platforms, or that actually it's sort of nicking a bit of market share?
Yeah, I think they've got a competitive advantage, and it goes back to the point that they own their technology. And I think it's quite well known to a lot of your listeners and us in the industry that there's famously been some very poor replatforming of systems, and for those companies that don't own their own technology, it can sometimes be a very, very expensive endeavor to replatform the business, and it can be very, very disruptive. And in fact, they tend to, those companies that have gone through that process have often seen disruption and a loss of market share and a loss of funds under direction. So what you see with Transact is the absolute opposite. Because they own their technology, because they're very well invested, they've actually seen the benefit from that, and they've seen some market share gains from that point of view. You know, very broadly speaking, if they grow their funds under direction, you know, 10 to 15%, which is what they're currently doing, they can actually charge their customers less every year and still grow their revenues double digit. Their costs don't need to grow double digit, so they can grow their profits 15% on revenue growth of 10%, on funds under direction growth of 15%. And that is a very, very powerful model, and it's something the market is inevitably getting onto and will pay a very high multiple for, because the incremental profitability of this, the incremental profits that come through from this revenue growth are very, very healthy. The other thing I like about IntegraFin comes back to management, and we've spoken a bit about Tesco's management. We didn't really speak about Warren Easton, Rolls-Royce, who's integral to the business. But the nice thing about IntegraFin is that it's still run by the guy who founded the business over 25 years ago, a guy called Ian Taylor. The other thing I like is that this company, and which is why it may not be that well known to you and to others, is that it IPO'd in February. Now, on the IPO, Ian Taylor didn't sell a single share in the business. He still owns, I think it's 40% or so of the equity, and he has no intention of selling. He knows he's built a great business, and he's absolutely aligned with shareholders on account of that. And it also comes through from the way that they manage their business, their net cash. They pay a very healthy dividend, which obviously comes back to your clients in the form of dividends, that comes back to Ian Taylor in the form of dividends. Their capital allocation is phenomenal, and that gives me a lot of comfort for the business as well.
Okay, so you've got sort of nice tailwind from, or you're not, some nice structural factors in play, that it's got good technology and there's a sort of a savings tailwind, and you like the management. But what sort of mistakes can this business make that could, you know, be unhelpful to share price? I mean, what could they do? Could they start pricing things in? Well, what mistakes could they make?
I think you've just hit the nail on the head. If we see prices going up to their customers, that would be a massive red flag to us. And when you read your clients read broker notes, or they hear things in the market about negative points towards the fact that their revenue margins are falling, i.e. they're charging their financial advisors less every year to use their platform, you know, if you think that that's a bear case, think again. It's not. What we love to see are those companies that are competitively advantaged actually reducing the cost of serving their customers to their business. Of serving their customers. Actually charging their customers less every year is a very, very powerful message. And if you have, if you own your technology and you can be disruptive to your competitors in that way, you know, that can be very powerful. And IntegraFin, if they started to raise prices and to take advantage of their scale and drive prices up for their customers, you know, that would be a warning sign for us.
Okay, thank you, Blake. A really insightful half an hour there and showcasing great knowledge of those companies and hopefully giving our listeners some additional things to think about when viewing those companies. And to those listeners, we ask, do leave us some feedback. Let us know what you think on iTunes or SoundCloud. Please visit the website and let us know what you think. But until next time, many thanks for listening.